Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of October. Coming up on the programme, South Africa's rugby equity deal goes into extra time. Will the upcoming midterm budget dim some of the Government of National Unity's shine? Find out why a medicine regulator is calling on National Treasury to up its funding, and a 106-year-old NGO faces closure come December. The South African Rugby Union has postponed a vote on the sale of equity to a US consortium due to pressure from the sports minister. The delay reflects growing concerns over the implications of the deal for the future of South African rugby, the sale sparking debate regarding ownership, governance, and the long-term sustainability of the sport. Andy Calhoun is the General Manager of Corporate Affairs at the South African Rugby Union and joins me first up on the programme. And Andy, first of all, why has SARU postponed the vote then as far as the sale is concerned?
Yes, we had a communication from the Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture, Mr. Gayton McKenzie, on the morning of a President's Council meeting in Cape Town. The day before, we had scheduled a special general meeting to consider a proposal by the Ackerley Sports Group to buy a 20% shareholding in a new commercial rights company. His point of view, and we have every sympathy with him, was that it was a very newsworthy and highly reported and discussed proposed transaction, and he asked for more time to consider and to hear again from us. We have previously briefed him on the subject, but he did ask an opportunity to speak once again on the subject.
Do you think that SARU's jumped the gun on this issue?
We started the conversation in 2018 with an organization called CVC Capital Partners. That conversation ran through 2019, kind of semi-paused during COVID, resumed in 2022 and 2023, and was a conversation that our members, who have the final say on such transactions, had clearly mandated us to proceed with. So it has been coming a long time. In December last year, the Ackerley Sports Group and CVC made a presentation to our members, and the members identified unanimously Ackerley Sports Group as their preferred bidder. So we have then been in a period of negotiation with them, and we have now got to the point where we have a negotiated agreement on the terms that were first presented to the members. So it probably, in terms of this year, we have moved ahead as fast as we could. But the process, the conversation, the need has been long identified.
What's the strategic thinking behind the sale?
Well, there's a number of objectives. The first one is that SA Rugby has zero reserves. If we had another COVID, we would be wiped out as a sport, or we'd be playing amateur rugby. So one of the first planks of any equity deal, regardless of who it would be to create a reserve that SA Rugby could fund itself through times of trouble. Secondly, we always have a short-term budgetary issue in any year, but that's a small part of it. But the biggest reason is that this preferred partner, the Ackerley Sports Group, will open us to networks, to platforms, to future corporate partners that, as SA Rugby, we just don't have access to at the moment. We're a business that breaks even just about by the skin of our teeth on an annual basis, but it's always a struggle. And if you compare our business to that of some of our European and our peers in New New Zealand. We are a small commercial operation compared to them. I think the most graphic example is the New Zealand, the sponsors on the New Zealand jersey earn eight times as much as the Springbok sponsors that we earn from our Springbok jersey sponsors. So we lag commercially. And with Accolade's expertise and experience in various sports around the world, we believe that they can take us, really make a step change in our commercial prospects.
The argument is that you haven't looked hard enough at alternative funding strategies to maintain financial stability. Is that fair?
There were other considerations. Simple loans were considered, but we regarded that as just dumb money and it doesn't help you grow the business. We also spoke to several other interested partners, both from the Middle East, from other South African potential investors, from other European investors. And when it came to the end of the line, as it were, there were only two parties still standing. And that's why we arrived at that decision last December to go with the Accolades.
Andy, there is a concern that any equity sale could impact the governance of South African rugby. In other words, influence is lost.
Well, there's a very clear distinction between the two entities. What will happen is that if this deal were to go through, or if a future equity deal with a different partner was to go through, a commercial rights company would be created in which all of the broadcast rights, the sponsorship rights, the licensing and eventing rights would be vested, 80% of that retained by SA Rugby. There will be a board created with six members, three from SA Rugby, three from the investor, and then an independent chairman who would be nominated by the investor and approved and signed off by SA Rugby. So they will then shape the commercial future of this organization. And that gives them control over that side of the business. What we see, the expertise that they will bring will be particularly around digital transformation and fan engagement. We've got a large online following at SA Rugby, but we've never had the resources or the skills and the expertise to create a meaningful relationship at a digital level with that audience. And on the other side, the contracts of Rassie Erasmus, of Sia Khaleesi, of the Springboks, of our Springbok women, of our Sevens teams, all of our competitions, they'll be run by the existing SA Rugby structures.
What's the plan if the sports minister says no deal?
Well, he first of all, he would be in a little bit of trouble for interfering, which I think he is averse to doing because of sort of global sporting regulations about what happens to teams at which sports get interfered. You then get taken off international rosters. But if for whatever reason the deal was not to go ahead, SA Rugby will continue as it does at the moment. I'm sure we would then begin to look at a different route with a different investor, by a different process, but the need will remain. We're a business that, as I say, is struggles each year to break even. We have very little funding from government. It's 0.0004% of our income. Everything we earn from sponsors, from gate tickets, from broadcast goes back into the playing of the game. So we do need to make a step change. So we would continue to search and probably by a different route and maybe by a different process.
Just a final question. In terms of the bigger rugby fraternity in South Africa and the union specifically, is there broad consensus that this is a good thing and that it will even influence and assist local rugby development?
I think the fact that they unanimously approved both seeking private equity partnership, and identifying the Accolade Sports Group was an indication that they do see that this is a route that's needed. Obviously, in the most recent weeks, there have been concerns raised about the structure of this deal and some of the finer detail of it. We hope that we're addressing that. We're continuing to address that with our members. But yeah, I think there's general consensus that this is the way to go. And the simple fact that our four United Rugby Championship franchises have their own private equity investment would indicate that there's broad acknowledgement that we cannot do rugby things in rugby ways without help from corporate expertise.
Andy Calhoun, GM Corporate Affairs at the South African Rugby Union, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let me pivot now from rugby to politics, although sometimes it's very difficult to spot the difference. Sentiments about the Government of National Unity have been divided, some poo-pooing the entire concept, others cautiously optimistic about a potential increase in accountability. But whatever side you find yourself on, the midterm budget speech by the Finance Minister, it takes place on the 30th of October, is going to find it difficult to create political space for President Ramaphosa. That's according to my next guest, columnist and commentator Peter Bruce, who also presents the podcast Podcasts from the Edge. Peter, thank you very much for your time today. The importance of this budget in terms of confidence in the coalition setup or the GNU, how critical is it, do you think?
Hi, Jeremy. Yeah, look, it's an important budget. It's taken quite a long time between election and now to put numbers to what the government wants to do. So this is going to be a big test, and we'll be able to see how ambitious they're being and whether their ambitions are real or sort of fantastical. Very important questions to be answered in the budget about, you know, whether the government can partially or find a constructive way to spend its way out of trouble and back in growth or not.
Peter, I would imagine walking a tightrope for the finance minister would probably be a whole lot easier because of the fragmented nature of the setup. Is government going to be forced into making more ideologically charged decisions that are going to appease all participants in this very messy setup sometimes?
I'm not sure that it will be. In fact, if anything, it may be the opposite. It's clear, and you will have seen from reports at the weekend, Sunday Times lead, where there was an obvious argument in Cabinet on Friday about funding for things like the National Health Insurance and other projects. And so what the disagreement on Friday in Cabinet did was to bring home, if anybody needed to be told, that you're in a coalition now, buddy, and, you know, people disagree all the time. So what happened on Friday was that there was disagreement about funding for the NHR. So the funding with the NHR was brought to the table by the health department, and they were basically told to go away. They didn't get their way. So it means that the finance minister doesn't have a number to put in the budget for NHR because there's no agreement in the cabinet on it. And so it gets delayed, which in this case is a sensible thing to do. And so it doesn't get spent on that ideological project. So in that sort of, in the sense that it stops things from, the GNU stops things from happening, coalition politics make it harder to waste money.
But there's a flip side to that, is that it's all very good to have the wheels spinning as far as NHI is concerned, given the exorbitant numbers that this could eventually cost. But on the other hand, you don't want it to gridlock any important spending on critical policy initiatives.
Yeah. Well, this is the important thing. So, you know, the government spends, I think we are debt levels, the national debt now is about 75% of GDP, which is quite high for South Africa. And it costs a lot of money to service that. I think somebody mentioned the other day about 2 billion rand a day just to pay the interest on the debt that we owe. And so what the government needs to understand about the budget is that it's not how much it borrows, but what it's borrowing for. You know, at the moment, we borrow money to pay teacher salaries and things like that. It's absolutely crazy. And those sorts of things don't play well in the market. But if you're borrowing for investment, if you're borrowing to improve competitiveness of your economy, if you're borrowing to improve the productivity of your economy, you know there's a case for even arguing that they don't belong in the same column as your other debts. These are investments. So if this GNU can turn its face to the sort of wind and say, look, we are going to out there, we're going to borrow money, but we're going to invest it in productive things that we need to do, and you can look around and count the crises, you know, water, energy we've overcome for the moment, but there'll be more, and logistics is another one, very slow, very difficult projects, and they're not being run by the right people. So those things all got to be remanaged. And I think it's easier to do it in a coalition like this than if the, you know, with one dominant party simply getting its own way all the time.
Do you think the ANC has got the courage to turn its head to the wind? And I guess that's a question about how stable you think this coalition government is right now.
Well, you know, if it doesn't, it will continue to lose ground. The only way that it's going to save itself is by growing the economy. And you can only grow the economy if you invest in it. You know, we're in a debt trap at the moment. If your rate of growth of your GDP is lower than the rate of interest you pay on your debt, you're lost, and you can never make it up. So you're in a trap, and the only way to get out of the trap is to really grow, to make your rate of growth, you know, at least equal the interest that you're paying on the debt you already have. And that is possible, but we have to be more sort of, you know, what the Germans call consequent about it. Consequent. I mean, you have to be more determined, and you have to be prepared to be cruel about who runs things, who can run things. You look at Transnet. Transnet has made a complete mess of this project now to concession Durban's container terminal to a private sector company. It was decided a year ago. It's just been put off for another 6 months. Nothing is happening. Nothing is happening. You know, on the railway network, literally nothing has happened. Mm. So, those things need to be driven by hard people. You know, not political appointments and nice in the corporate photographs. They've got to be driven by experts and people who are tough-minded. And they may not all belong to the ANC, I'm afraid.
Do you think this budget would be an easier game for the finance minister to play if there was more concordance on a broader policy narrative as far as the coalition is concerned, which we don't really seem to know?
Yeah, well, we haven't, in a way, the budget will help define that concordance, if I'm not stretching the question too far, because there hasn't been an attempt yet to publicly map out what an economic vision is. So there's a sort of, you know, there's a sort of medium-term development plan, which is what the Friday cabinet meeting was about. But it's simply, you know, what has happened is that the Department of Planning and Monitoring, I think, puts together, it's a cut and paste job. Every minute departments send in their proposals, the Department of Planning pastes them all into a document and sends it off to cabinet, unfiltered, undiscussed, and that's where things fall apart. So somebody has got to take the lead in government, and it might well be the Treasury, could be the presidency, but he seems to be hesitant, you know, to lead from the front. He's rather pushing from behind. But you're right, you know, until somebody actually says, this is what we're trying to do, there'll always be questions, and there'll always be room, you know, to wiggle out of making the hard decisions. And that may be end up where, you know, it may end, that may be where we end up. This is not a government of, or the ANC under Cyril and, you know, previously, has wobbled on all the big decisions. They inherited a lot of things. They pretty much wrecked many of them. And the fixes are hard to swallow because they're not things that you can do yourself. Eskom did it right, but all Eskom did was, you know, was fix the damage that it had caused on its own to its fleet. And that was a relatively easy thing to do. Other problems facing the government are much more complex, involving more players and actors. Logistics, getting your the minerals that you mine to ports is a really complex thing. You know, just getting a car from Rosslyn in Pretoria, BMW, to the port in Durban is a massive task. Yeah. You've got to get that car through the railway network through Joburg. It can take days. Well, and that's, you know, those problems just don't get easier with time.
Well, more clarity, or perhaps not, on October the 30th. Peter Bruce, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's medicines regulator, SAHPRA, is calling on the National Treasury for increased funding. The regulator faces budget constraints that limit its ability to fulfill its mandate of ensuring access to safe, effective and affordable medicines. The chief executive officer of SAHPRA, Boitumelo Semete Mako Kotlela, has emphasized that more resources are needed to address the backlog in drug approvals and to manage emerging health crises. Good afternoon to you and a very warm welcome. Why then are you asking National Treasury for more funding?
Thank you, firstly, Jeremy, for having me on this show. The reason why we ask in National Treasury for funding is because as a national regulator, you know, you need to be able to be in a position wherein you can timeously review the applications that are submitted to the regulator. And what this means is that we need to have adequate human resources, because that's really the people that sit and review then these applications. You need to have them in an adequate number so that you can then make these decisions timeously. So as we speak, when we look at the number of applications that we receive and the capacity we have internally, it is limited. And hence, we have these constant delays with concluding any application that's submitted to us.
How much more money do you need?
So I'll give an example in terms of our headcount. So we're currently sitting at about 313 plus minus, and we need to be comfortably at a number of about 500. And this additional resources must be senior technical skill sets that would be able to conduct these. And therefore, then with an increase of about, 200 plus minus, it will then impact our cost of employment. And that's really the answer that we are seeking from National Treasury. Yes, we do charge fees for the work that we do. However, you cannot be, as a regulator, reliant only on fees that you charge.
To what extent is the backlog in approval impacting public health, or is it too early to say?
No, it's not too early to say. It has an impact, because you can imagine there are many products that are developed and innovated outside of the country, and the pharmaceutical industry and the medical devices industry bring those to South Africa for them to be reviewed within a certain time so that they're then accessed by the public. So the consequence of us not making decisions timely is that there are patients that require medicines, but those are not available in the country because they still have to go through this rigorous review process by the regulator, which is indeed a very important exercise because we need to safeguard the safety of the public. However, the delays are leading to a delay in access to health products.
And what is the pharmaceutical sector saying to you?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting a lot of pressure from the sector because you can imagine this is a sector that operates in other countries, and those countries would have shorter timelines than South Africa. So if you look at countries like the US FDA, like the US where they have the US FDA, the UK where they have the MHRA, their times are significantly shorter than what we have in South Africa. So industry is indeed, putting a lot of pressure on us to say, as a regulator, we need to be a lot more timeous with our decisions.
Is there a short-term fix that you can implement to handle the drug approval backlog?
Yeah, I mean, we're implementing a lot of operational efficiency projects internally, but also we've been fortunate to be in a position wherein we can engage with some of the philanthropic organizations that are submitting regulators across the continent. And we've been fortunate to raise some grant funding so that we can bring in resources on contract. But that's certainly not sustainable. And the problem that we raise as SAHPRA is not unique to us as SAHPRA. It is an acute problem on the continent.
If the money is not forthcoming and the backlog of approval continues to grow, is there a danger that medicines the desperate patients want simply come in through the back door?
No, that we're very clear on, that we're going to ensure that we safeguard the safety of the public. So we've got staff at the ports of entry who ensure that the products that are imported into the country are compliant with the Medicines Act, and even those that are manufactured locally, that they are compliant. So there we are extremely rigorous, even with the limited capacity. The only consequence of this limited capacity is that, you know, where you see what we call the substandard falsified products and we need to act, we cannot act quick enough. But certainly when something is raised with us, we do put resources into it and we act, because the safety of the public is critical. Mm.
And just quickly, what sort of response are you getting from National Treasury, and are you satisfied?
Yeah, I mean, we've been engaging with them for some time. So, I mean, even this call that we're making for them to support us to a much larger extent is not, foreign to them. We've had these discussions with them. We understand that the country is under significant fiscal constraints. However, you cannot compromise the health of the public. And this, for us, is such an important institution that, as South Africa, we really need to make sure that we safeguard it. We need to make sure that we protect it, because it is a critical institution that ensures the safety of our public. We've seen the role that the regulator played during the pandemic. We needed to ensure that vaccines and all the therapies that come into the country are compliant with safety, quality, and efficacy standards. So this is such an important institution for the country that we're asking that it really be supported to the extent that it's required.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
I want to end the program on a philanthropic note, and the Epworth Children's Village, it's a haven for vulnerable children for over 106 years, faces closure in a matter of weeks due to financial challenges and the absence of government support. Corporate South Africa is now being called upon to step up its CSR efforts to help keep the home open. I'm in conversation now with Karen Ulafia, business manager at Waco Modular. This is an organization that supports the village. Karen, thank you very much indeed. What immediate risks then do the children face if this institution closes?
There's obviously a lot to be said about the current situation of all our NGOs in South Africa. But immediate risk is there's going to be a lot of kids who don't have a place to stay, who's not going to be cared for. So it's going to be a huge problem if we don't take action right now.
On a wider scale, many organizations like the Epworth Children's Village and others are in trouble. I know that organizations like yours provide funding, but do you think the problem is just funding, or do you think it's more systemic, that maybe we need to relook at the entire model here?
I do think it needs to be taken up by many other role players. Government is failing, so other role players must step in, or otherwise we're going to have a serious crisis on hand.
What urgent steps then can businesses take to save this particular organization or this institution?
In my opinion, businesses shouldn't just do a once-off donation. CSR is not just that. We believe businesses should improve on their CSR policy and don't just donate. Become a create a partnership. Find a company that you can go and create a partnership. Spend time with the people. Spend time with the staff, the kids of the place. Get involved. Make sure that these places are sustainable. Make a difference in more than just money.
And that's a very good point that you raise, but I would counter by saying that business itself is under so much pressure when it comes to requests from organizations such as this one. It's difficult to make a choice, and they have a limited amount of money that they're able to spend on CSR projects.
Absolutely. When we started with our CSR initiative, when the group rolled out the policy, it was very clear that we are not just going to do just donations. We had to pick, and we picked to focus on the youth. I mean, that's the future leaders, the people who's going to be economically working and contributing to us. So we had to pick and find a niche where we were going to support. So, and then we went and we found companies like, for example, Epworth, that we support. So we had to be very specific in our focus, and we chose the youth to make a difference where it's most needed.
So you say to me that it's not just about donations. Obviously, donations are critical, but it's also lending your time and looking at assisting with infrastructure and that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, any corporate is going to say, well, I need some sort of measurability as far as my efforts are concerned. So how have you done that within your organization to make sure that there is at least not necessarily a return on investment, but at least a return on time?
Absolutely. We have key KPIs that we measure for our CSR. We work with companies who's properly registered so that we can get the donation certificate. We manage our times. We claim our man hours. Of course, all of those things are measurable. So it's not just the money in. It's also really the benefit comes from the joy on the faces of the kids after you've done all your events and interactions.
So you've put out an SOS as far as this particular institution is concerned. What specifically are you looking for?
We're asking companies to get involved, not just giving money, but give your time, give your skills, share your knowledge. Great roles in your company where the kids, once they finish with school, can come and become part of your business. Remember, at the age of 18, these kids are almost kicked out of the system because now they're seen as an adult. So that's a huge gap. Child probably didn't finish his matric, so he's sitting with this problem: where do I go? How do I finish my schooling? It is such a big gap. So it's not just also looking after the kids until they turn 18, it's also that gap from 18 into adulthood that we need to look at.
It really does sound to me as it's a call of desperation, given that it's quite unusual for one business that is supporting an institution like this to be asking other businesses to come on board. Obviously, you would have thought very long, hard and carefully about it.
Absolutely. This place is 106 years old in November. They're celebrating 106 years of making a difference. So let's just assume 5 kids leave them every year. That's 530 people that got a chance in life. If we don't do something about this, where's the next 530 people going to go? They're going to end up in street, need to be supported by government. It's unthinkable of more generations that's going to fall down into a spiral instead of being safe.
What about government funding? And you mentioned the lack of it. How has this affected the daily operations at Epworth?
So obviously the Department of Social Development is responsible to look after Epworth and other NGOs. However, for the 18 months before the 2nd of April, when they announced they're going to close, they didn't get any money. So the directors of Epworth tried to borrow money, and the mountain of debt that Epworth currently sit is a mountain that they are really, really battling to even just climb at this lowest of levels. So at that stage, Epworth took the Department of Social Development to court. They got 6 months worth of money, which is a drop in the bucket. So as it stands at the moment, it's like putting a plaster over a patient that has got 90% burn wounds over them. It's unthinkable where this is going to end up.
Karen Olivier, thank you very much indeed. It's a problem facing your organization, but I would imagine food for thought for other companies in South Africa that are close to corporate social responsibility programs. Thank you for your time today. And on our online poll today, the upcoming mini budget, I was in conversation with columnist Peter Bruce a little earlier, and my question to you today is, do you think there'll be more pain, or do you think it'll be better than in previous years? If you've got a view on that, remember it takes place on October the 30th. You can participate either on our LinkedIn or X feeds. That's also our show for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.